Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
One of the president's ride or die defenders is legal advisor Jenna Ellis.
It's such a political prosecution and a political persecution.
Quote.
This to me is a clear violation of the Fourth Amendment. It's revisionist originalism. Tolerance just isn't a two-way street with the Democrats. And I think that tells you all we need to know.
Newsmax contributor and former legal counsel to President Trump.
Jenna Ellis.
Well, good morning. It is Monday, and this is already set to be an unprecedented week. And, you know, I'm kind of tired of that word. It's like, can't we get back to more precedented times? Like, remember when we all just kind of followed the news casually and there were things going on in America, not like, oh, the former president is indicted and has to go up to Manhattan to respond to this ridiculously outrageous weaponization of government. I mean, remember when things like that didn't happen in the United States of America? Well, I'm old enough to remember that. Shocking, I know, but I am. And, you know, this is just a complete spiral of events that are leading further and further into a country that is just unrecognizable. And, you know, love or hate Donald Trump, this entire arc of his saga and how the leftist, never Trumper Democrats and everyone on the left has specifically targeted him in order to oust him from first getting even into office, then trying to get him out of office, and now trying to get him off the campaign trail and excised from his campaign and not back into office again, is totally un-American. Because last time I checked, the U.S. Constitution does not have a requirement that you be a political nice guy or you be endorsed by the Democratic Party in order to run for United States of America and for the president of the United States of America. And so this whole weaponization of government is not just against Donald Trump, but I think he's the tip of the spear, but it's against what has increasingly become a far larger and wider swath of conservatives and of Americans that simply are disfavored by the current political regime. And that is completely antithetical to America's founding. That's antithetical to the U.S. Constitution, to due process, to our fundamental God-given rights that our government is supposed to protect. And this is why a lot of people are standing up and saying, this should not happen. And this isn't just about, you know, no one is above the law and Donald Trump has to go and answer to these things. Because from what we know currently, there's nothing that has been alleged so far that Donald Trump really needs to answer for that's outside or of the statute of limitations, that has failed in previous questions of whether it would be prosecuted. This is just a political weaponization. And so as we look at what is going on in the whole scope of the United States, I'm very glad to be joined by our good friend, Representative Mike Collins, this morning to talk about this and to respond to not just the indictment of President Trump, which media outlets are calling to be unsealed now so that we can actually talk more about what the specifics are. And of course, when that happens, we'll get to that, whether it's today or tomorrow in the forthcoming days. But Representative Collins, I want to ask you just first off, how do you respond to this indictment of a former sitting president of the United States? It's never happened before in America's history. Why is this happening now? And do you think that the Democrats even have any leg to stand on whatsoever when they say, well, it's just we know Donald Trump's a criminal. So, you know, this isn't about politics. This is all about the law.
Well, good morning, Jen. I appreciate you having me on. And what you said when you opened up the segment, I think, is so important because I look at things not from a because I'm nowhere near a lawyer, and I don't speak in legal terms, but I do speak and I look at it from a business person, a small business person, just a layman out here. And it's just everywhere you turn, you're exactly right. It just seems like there is a barrage of different things coming at the American public to take away our rights, to suppress us, to scare us, to do anything they can to push a social agenda. And there's one thing at the top of the spear. You're exactly right, and that's Donald Trump, President Trump. And when he won in 2016 and started exposing everything and bringing to light the way that this country has moved so far left, that the left knows that they have to get rid of him or try to get rid of him. And that's the only thing they can do to actually stop this movement from the right. And sure, this is politically motivated. Everybody sees that. You know, and the feds wouldn't take it up. Letitia James wouldn't take it up from the state. Man, you've got this Bragg guy, that local DA campaign saying he was going to get Trump any way he could. Doesn't prosecute real crime in New York, but yet he's going to try to prosecute former president of the United States. The biggest thing that I see coming out of this right now is $5 million that were donated to Donald Trump's campaign. That ought to speak volumes. That is the average American out there across this country that is waking up and saying that we are sick and tired of this mess. We're not taking any more. We're going to back our quarterback. And when he gets to New York, we'll still be behind him tomorrow.
Yeah, and Representative Mike Collins, I think you're correct that we've seen the surge in the polls for President Trump. We've seen that fundraising that's come in, and those aren't big dollar donors. Those are the average American who is sick and tired of this and who's saying we're going to stand behind President Trump. And I think regardless of how the GOP primary ultimately shapes out, I think that the one thing that we all can coalesce behind, and I'm glad to see literally all of the other Republicans, I mean, including President Trump's campaign rivals and unannounced rivals like Ron DeSantis, and literally everyone who is standing behind him and saying this is not only unprecedented, but it's unwarranted. This is something that should never happen in the United States of America. And as we look at where this country is going, I think that you are right that the donations speak volumes, because this is something that the average person can do to feel like they're helping in some small way. And so from your seat in Congress, I know that there are the select committees on the weaponization of government, some other things that you are also involved in. But what is the what's the feeling among Republicans in Congress as you all are looking at what's going on forthcoming tomorrow in Manhattan?
Well, it's not just the other potential candidates against Donald Trump for the GOP nomination. It should be every Republican in this country standing up and standing behind President Trump. And the reason is because if they can do that to him, just think of what they can do to anybody else, much less a little city, you know, House member in Congress. You know, that ought to wake everybody up. That's what the politicization of this judicial system is. It is purely a two-tiered justice system. We've been seeing that. You know, we've seen that ever since January 6th happened, with two-tiers, how they're treating Republicans. We've seen that even back when the IRS was targeting Republicans. But the one biggest thing that Congress can do besides stand up for our former president, stand behind him, is make sure that we continue to do oversight. It's one of the best things I've seen going on in Washington. We've got other things we've got to tackle up there right now. But this oversight with not just the weaponization of government, but the China problem that we have out there, the fact that we need to be looking at every federal agency and how they've been spending money for the last 10 years with these omnibus bills where we just throw money at them and tell them to go have a good time. So oversight is very important right now, so that we can continue to expose just what's been going on in our federal government.
That's such a great point, Representative Mike Collins, that continuing to expose what's actually going on and using the power of the legislative branch to do that when currently we have what I would call a runaway executive and a judiciary that's hesitant at the moment at best, and it's certainly weaponized in some particular aspects. We'll see how this judge treats former President Trump, but continuing the oversight and continuing also the business of the American people as all of this continues to happen really is one of the most effective tools, especially as you look at the forthcoming Republican primary. And then ultimately, we, of course, have to be concerned about the general election and making sure that the independents, the moderates, and maybe even some Democrats, when they look at what's actually going on, I don't know any even parents that are Democrats, other than, you know, the far, far leftists, like the ones that are happily sending their kids to, you know, drag queen story time. I mean, you know, those people need some worldview corrections for sure. But, you know, but the average parent in America still, they want to know what's going on in their child's school. They want to be able to speak up at a school board meeting. They don't want to just be targeted and put on, you know, by the government and put on some domestic terrorist watch list. I mean, these are the types of things that regular people who aren't so party conscious and aren't already siloed into this kind of tribalistic mentality will care about. And you mentioned, and we only have a couple of minutes here, so I want to also get to a really important piece of legislation that you are helping with, because I think it is important in the context of everything going on with Donald Trump, and as we're following this, to also recognize there are other issues that are still facing the American people that are so important. And so you and a bipartisan group of science committee members have introduced legislation to combat the spread of quote-unquote zombie drug, which is basically the spread of novel synthetic opioids. And this is incredibly important. And during my work in Colorado as first a prosecutor, then a defense attorney, and in Colorado, we had Amendment 64, which basically opened Pandora's box to legalizing marijuana. But it also legalized, unfortunately, a lot of well, didn't necessarily legalize it, but it opened the door to a lot of these other synthetic opioids that have a lot more of a potent effect. So so this is incredibly important. And what's your goal with this legislation?
It is. And you know, Jenna, it's not as sexy as me signing on to get rid of the Department of Education, which I did, or the ATF, which we need to get rid of. But it's just an administrative, what I call back office type of bill. And it just directs the National Institute of Standards and Technology to come up with something to combat this new trank that's out there. You know, fentanyl is deadly as it is. And we've seen almost a 200% increase here in the southern states, almost a 2,000% increase in Georgia alone with fentanyl crossing the border. And with Title 42 scheduled to expire in May, you're going to see even more people just pouring across that border. But this is going to require research to come up with ways to combat the veterinarian tranquilizer that's being added to fentanyl, and to protect our border agents and our law enforcement out there. We need to be doing all we can to protect those folks, and this is a good step towards doing that.
Absolutely it is. And I think that that a lot of people are waking up to how bad the fentanyl and opioid crisis is, and how this really needs to stop coming in from the border. And securing our border isn't just about illegal immigration. It's about so many other things.
Oh, it is. You know, I had someone over the weekend tell me that they were talking to someone that was Hispanic. And he said, well, you know, we used to carry marijuana across the border. That was our product. And now that marijuana is being legalized all across the U.S., we had to come up with something else.
Wow.
That's scary.
It really is. And, you know, we're seeing the effects of that. And, you know, and again, even just in my home state of Colorado, seeing how so many of the synthetic drugs now are being distributed, and there's just a huge crisis there. I really hope that this will pass and will be very effective. And thank you for focusing on the work of Congress, not just everything that's going on in the news cycle, but really appreciate all of your work and always having you on, Representative Mike Collins. And we will be following, of course, everything going on with President Trump in Manhattan. And Greg Jarrett, who is a legal analyst with Fox News, joins me next to break down more about the legal aspects of the indictment. So we will be right back here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. We'll be right back.
The following is not an actor, but a real-life story from Trinity Debt Management.
I'm Corey, and this is my story. I was going through some financial troubles paying off my credit cards. I was paying high interest rates, and it just wasn't getting any better. And I knew I had to do something. So my mom told me about Trinity, and so I decided to call. Trinity was able to do something that I couldn't. I'm paying off my debt, I'm saving thousands, and things are really looking up. I promise you guys, you will not regret it when you call Trinity, because it was such a relief and less stress in my life, and it was the best thing I could have done for myself, because once I called Trinity, they took care of me, and I felt such a relief, a weight off my shoulders, and they are a Christian-based company. I love it.
If you're in debt and you need help, call Trinity at 1-800-788-1813.
I'm Corey, and I'm debt-free for keeps.
1-800-788-1813.
This is Pause to Pray, a chance each day to stop down from the daily noise of life and pray for our country's leaders.
Today, we pray for Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders of Arkansas. She is the former White House press secretary and has served as governor since January. Proverbs 16:3 reminds us of the character and conduct we seek in our leaders. Commit your work to the Lord, and your plans will be established. Right now, with this in mind, let's pray together. Almighty God, we ask for guidance for Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders as she leads the people of Arkansas each day. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Pause to Pray is a service of this station and the Presidential Prayer Team, a nonprofit, nonpartisan ministry dedicated to encouraging prayer for our nation's leaders. To learn more, go to pausetopray.org.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes. Stand by for news and commentary next.
Liberty University's K-12 online academy is the best of a homeschool, private school, and Bible-based education all rolled into one. With LUOA, you can take charge of your child's learning environment and create a structured yet flexible schedule that works for your family. Our qualified teachers are easily accessible for guidance and support along the way. And with new classes starting every Monday, it's never too late to make a switch to LUOA. To learn more, text LUOA to 88741. That's LUOA to 88741.
A high school teacher boasted on social media about creating an explicitly queer space in his taxpayer-funded classroom. The teacher kept his name and location private. He said most days he comes to school wearing stilettos, boasting about standing 6'6" in heels. The teacher also bragged about coming to school in drag and makeup. He said school administrators had no problem with his behavior, and they were just glad he was making a safe space for kids. Now, this guy is a sex and gender revolutionary, using his classroom to indoctrinate and confuse kids. Whatever happened to teaching young people to be good and productive members of society? Whatever happened to reading and writing and math and science? And whatever happened to teachers who used to wear sensible shoes in the workplace? Homeschool your children, America. My new book makes a terrific stocking stuffer, Our Daily Biscuit Devotions with Withdrawal, available right now at ToddStarnes.com.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Well, we are no longer on indictment watch. We are in indictment reality here in America, and this is completely unprecedented. And if you are just joining, we are covering this today, as well as, of course, looking forward to tomorrow, when former President Trump has indicated that he will be flying up to Manhattan, leaving Mar-a-Lago about noon today, and then will be in the Manhattan courthouse tomorrow morning to get arraigned. And so Greg Jarrett, who is a legal analyst on Fox News and has a new book, The Trial of the Century, that you can pre-order now at thegregjarrett.com, joins me now to discuss. And Greg, you have a piece that is titled Trump's Indictment Rests on This Bizarre Legal Theory and Has Three Major Flaws. So let's get into the particulars of that. But first off, what do you expect from the arraignment tomorrow morning, and whether or not this infamous mugshot will be taken and distributed?
Well, you know, the process is common and perfunctory, if you will. Trump fills out a bunch of forms. He's fingerprinted. He'll be moved to a courtroom somewhere in the 2 o'clock hour for an arraignment where the charges against him are read. And then I think his bail has been already prearranged, probably just no bail. He's released on his own recognizance. And then he'll fly off back to Mar-a-Lago. But I think that this is more proof, Jenna, that there is no system of justice anymore. There's only a legal system, and it's corrupt. This is an abusive, vindictive indictment of Donald Trump that is based on a feeble, lame interpretation of the law. And as I wrote in the column you referenced, there are all kinds of legal obstacles that Bragg faces. Non-disclosure agreements in exchange for money are legal. Second of all, it would have to be shown that Trump himself was somehow involved in falsifying records. CEOs generally don't do that, especially of large corporations. And finally, Alvin Bragg would have to prove that Trump not only understood these complex, convoluted campaign laws that nobody really comprehends, but that he intended, by virtue of his actions, to violate them. I mean, good luck trying to prove that.
Well, Greg Jarrett, you raise a really great point that this is a bootstrapped claim onto a manipulated law that is the action is actually outside the statute of limitations. I mean, no reasonable prosecutor under these circumstances would bring such a case, and it's obviously politically motivated. And so what do you think that Alvin Bragg's ultimate goal is here when you're seeing Donald Trump rise by double digits in the polls? You're seeing him fundraise close to $5 million, and this case likely won't be resolved unless there's some procedural dismissal at the beginning, which should happen, until after the GOP primary. So, is this just about draining his war chest? Is it just, not even about the election as much as it is just an intense, crazy focus to get Donald Trump?
Well, you have to recall that Alvin Bragg, an uber progressive, ran on the campaign pledge of prosecuting Trump, which is egregiously unethical and a violation of the canons of ethics that govern prosecutors. He vowed to exploit the immense powers of his office, if elected, to bring down the former president. Never mind that he was not privy to any evidence or documents that Trump had ever violated the law, but being bereft of facts didn't deter him from publicly accusing Trump of felonious conduct. And then, of course, upon assuming office, he launched an investigation in search of a crime, which is anathema to the duty of public prosecutions. He did drop the case immediately, but then a public pressure campaign led him to reverse course, and he caved in. And he adopted this, as I say, ludicrous legal theory to fulfill his promise to voters and, to satisfy his party benefactors. But most of all, I think he wants to advance his own career. He's politically ambitious. I think he sees himself as the hero of the Democratic Party. When in fact, I think in the end, he'll be the goat.
Yeah, and this is so, you're describing this Greg Jarrett. I'm sitting here thinking this is the plot of a Hollywood movie script, where you have the obvious setup of the clash between, the righteous justice and then the evil, manipulative bad guy who is trying to become the petty tyrant and weaponize the system. And yet somehow in our mainstream media, they don't see any of this clash between good and evil or even the rule of law and the Constitution and preserving any of this. This is just about their insane focus as well to get Donald Trump. And they're actually wanting to have a judge impose a gag order on Donald Trump, which, you know, a gag order isn't totally uncommon in a criminal case. And they're put in place to ensure there's a fair trial for defendants and that, you know, some of these pretrial statements don't influence jurors. But I don't think you're going to find a juror in Manhattan anywhere that hasn't heard of this already. And what do you make of a judge possibly imposing this? In my view, it would be just to prevent Trump from campaigning on this, for one thing. But second, getting his view out in the court of public opinion, which, as you and I are very well aware, that forum matters to Trump, and it ultimately matters for the election just as much as the actual court of law.
Now, gag orders on defendants who have a right to publicly plead their innocence, those are unconstitutional. Sadly, they happen all the time. And, you know, a lot of defendants don't challenge it because they don't have the financial wherewithal to do so. And it takes a lot of time to challenge the unconstitutionality of such gag orders. And you know, that's always an uphill battle. But look, the mainstream media, as you point out, has been cheering this on. They despise Donald Trump. They've been salivating over the possibility that, you know, he would be convicted. They've been acting like giddy children in a candy shop. But these are the same knuckleheaded journalists who abandon all fairness and objectivity and accuracy when they falsely accused Trump of colluding with Russia. They had no credible evidence. Their sloppiness and incompetence was breathtaking. I wrote about it in two books, The Russia Hoax and Witch Hunt. This was a shameful act of media malpractice. They assured their viewers and readers, oh, it's worse than Watergate. Trump is going to go to jail for being a secret Russian agent, and of course, it all turned out to be a hoax, you know, the greatest mass delusion in American political history, and, you know, the media deserves a huge share of blame for that. It was media malpractice on steroids, and the scary part is they're doing it all over again.
Right. And as we're sitting here watching this, I mean, it's amazing to see how the camps already are divided and how much the mainstream media is, as you characterize it, I think rightly, Greg Jarrett, just salivating over this potential conviction. I mean, people are literally suggesting, who are members of the mainstream media and who are clearly political opponents of Donald Trump, that you know, this, they're celebrating indictment day. I mean, this is something that is so far beyond what the justice system was intended for. And yet some in the media are also suggesting potentially that this isn't just about the hush money to the porn star. This could be about some other things. And of course, we don't have the indictment yet. Media organizations have asked the court to release that before tomorrow so that we can all pick it apart, of course. But do you anticipate that there's any potential merit to the 30 plus charges that go beyond just this, what we've all been focusing on, which is this this payment to Stormy Daniels? Is there anything possibly that could potentially be meritorious if there's something that's potentially with the Trump organization or something that we're just not aware of at the moment?
You know, I just don't see it. You know, this case was laughingly referred to in the Manhattan DA's office as the zombie case because it was repeatedly pronounced dead, only to be brought back to life. You know, Bragg himself killed it when he realized it was a farce. But, you know, his hatred of Trump was so consuming that he resurrected it from the grave. And to make that happen, you know, based on the leaks of what's in the indictment, he had to contort the law and twist the facts to, you know, jam a square peg into a legal round hole. Even some diehard liberals and notable Democrats are conceding that, you know, these charges are lame. And they grumble that the case is transparently political, which it is. And they fret that, you know, a failed prosecution may result in a public backlash with severe political consequences for their party, the Democratic Party. I think the real wreckage, Jenna, falls on the public's perception of our legal system, that it's no longer fair, that it's being weaponized to achieve a partisan purpose. You know, we'll wait and see what's in the indictment itself, but if they've taken, you know, one or two charges and multiplied them into 34 separate charges based on 34 reimbursement payments, you know, as Jonathan Turley, the law school professor at George Washington University, said, you know, that doesn't make it 34 times more legitimate or powerful. You know, increasing the quantity doesn't add to the value of a pathetically weak case.
Right. And Greg Jarrett, what you just said, I think, is so important and underscores the future precedent problem with this type of weaponization of government, is that most people now do not trust the legitimacy of law enforcement. They don't trust the system. They don't trust American justice. I mean, we used to be, and still, when it's working correctly, we have the best system of justice in the world. And certainly it's flawed, and we can talk about judicial reform. We can talk about criminal justice reform, all of those things to make it better. But when you have something like this, where you have political opponents, and I see this all over social media all the time, that people are suggesting that we need to just lock up our political opponents. I mean, this is just beyond the pale of what people used to understand as the United States of America, and they weren't advocating for a system that was so illegitimate. And just the last few minutes I have with you, you have a new book out that's called The Trial of the Century. And as I was looking at this page, I thought, you know, that could be a title that will be really a good moniker on the Trump trial if this ends up going there. So, I mean, so are you going to be poised to write another book if this case ends up in trial?
You know, I don't know. The Trial of the Century is about the legendary Scopes Monkey trial about 100 years ago. But, you know, it's relevant now more than ever. It foreshadowed today's culture wars, the fierce debates over free speech and academic autonomy. You know, especially the vocal conflict we have now over critical race theory in education. This was an epic battle over evolution versus creationism, science versus religion, but most of all, free speech. And, you know, that's what we find today so in jeopardy. And, you know, if you're going to criminalize politics, and, you know, weaponize our system of justice for partisan gain, you know, I think that Americans are going to react adversely to that. And I think they see that happening here in this particular case. I think it's regrettable. You know, Bill Barr, no fan of Trump's, called the charges an abomination. You know, Barr's an exceedingly smart guy. He knows the law more than anybody I know. And he says they're going after the man, not a crime. And, you know, he said this case is held together by chicken wire, paper clips, and rubber bands. It's a lousy case, and I hardly agree with the former two-time attorney general.
Yeah, it's so sad that we are at this point. And it's interesting, Greg Jarrett, that we have We're looking back 100 years in your book, The Trial of the Century, and we're all debating the very same issues. And this is why the torch of liberty and freedom has to be passed successfully from one generation to the next. So get the book, The Trial of the Century, at thegregjarrett.com. Always appreciate Greg Jarrett stopping by. We will be back with more on the now indictment of the former president when we come back right here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Hello, I'm Sam Rohr, president of the American Pastors Network, a growing national network of pastors committed to the authority of Scripture and preaching the whole counsel of God. We believe biblical obedience is the foundation for revival, and impacting our culture for Christ is our duty. For too long, the pulpits of America have been silent on the important issues such as marriage and family and assault on liberty. Join us in the battle for truth on Stand in the Gap weekend, Sunday evenings at 6 p.m. on American Family Radio, and visit us at AmericanPastorsNetwork.org.
Greetings, everyone. I'm Dr. Matt Ayers, president of Wesley Biblical Seminary. Did you know that there's a way to attend seminary where you don't have to write papers and you don't have to get graded? When you audit a course, you get to participate in the course and learn without earning the degree. You can sign up to audit any course at Wesley Biblical Seminary for only $250. Whether it's discipleship or the Old Testament or theology, you can audit a course this coming semester. Go to wbs.edu to sign up to audit. That's wbs.edu.
And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. Acts 17:26 conveys to us the reality that we were born and placed in the 21st century by God's specific design. He determined before time where we would live and when we would live there. If you're in Minnesota, Mississippi, or Maine, God put you there on purpose. He's not surprised by the darkness we see around us, nor is he caught off guard by it. In fact, he specifically prepared for it by making sure you're alive right now. God can do whatever he wants, but he's chosen to use you and me as ambassadors of his kingdom. We are his torches to light up the darkness.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Your health care is just that. It's your health care. It's yours. You are unique. God made you. So instead of being a number in a system, think about being a part of a community, one made for you. MediShare is healthcare sharing. It's not health insurance. It's a community of Christians who actually care about you and the things that matter most to you, like your convictions. You want to know your money isn't paying for things you don't believe in. Instead, now you're sharing, you're helping real people, not a corporate bottom line. And when you have a need, they're there for you. Other MediShare members and staff even praying for you. For 30 years, MediShare has meant affordable, reliable healthcare. And when everything else seems to be getting more corporate and more impersonal, this is a breath of fresh air. And it may be just what you have been looking for. Call now. They're very easy to talk to. 833-44-BIBLE. That's 833-44-BIBLE. 833-44-BIBLE.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
So we are continuing to talk about this unprecedented indictment of former President Donald Trump. And he has, of course, announced that he will be leaving for Manhattan later today at noon Eastern time, and will go up to Trump Tower and then to the courthouse tomorrow in Manhattan. And my good friend Josh Hammer, who is the opinion editor at Newsweek and also a brilliant lawyer in his own right, he and I talked last week on my podcast, and you can find this on thejennaellisshow.com, about Governor DeSantis out of Florida. Of course, President Trump is a resident of Florida, and how the governor may or may not have a constitutional role here if President Trump had decided to challenge extradition. So, of course, this is now more of a hypothetical conversation, just because President Trump clearly has indicated that he is not intending to ask for a hearing in that regard. But it was interesting to me, and I wanted to bring Josh on the show this morning to talk about Governor DeSantis's response, because he actually came out and said in the wake of the announcement that the indictment was actually filed, that Florida will not assist in an extradition. So, Josh Hamer, this to me was very interesting. And as you and I had discussed last week, this was a little bit more than what Governor DeSantis had initially pledged in terms of his role. And so what does this tell you when the Florida governor is actually saying that and pledging his government to not assist if there had been a need for an extradition request?
So, Jenna, great to chat with you as always. So, you know, as we discussed on your podcast, as you mentioned, there is relevant Supreme Court precedent here. There's specifically there's a late 1980s case called Puerto Rico versus Branstad, which basically says that discretion is extremely limited when it comes to state governments, to state governors, to get in the middle of extraditions from one state to another, and ultimately that Article 4, Section 2, Clause 2 of the Constitution, the extradition clause, which deals with interstate extraditions, the court held in the Branstad case that ultimately this is enforceable judicially via a writ of mandamus necessary, which is basically legalese for saying that the court can effectively force the governor's hand. So my reading of that was and continues to be that the governor's constitutional role is very limited. Now, like you, it seems like when I first heard Governor DeSantis's tweet last Thursday in the aftermath of this appalling and unprecedented indictment from the Soros-funded prosecutor, Alvin Bragg, my initial reaction was, this is interesting. But then I actually went back and watched what Governor DeSantis initially said. And I don't think there's any discrepancy, actually. So if you look very carefully at what he said the first time versus what he said in the tweet on Thursday, the first time he said Florida will not, or he said, like, we're not going to, quote, get involved. So the question then, and this is like a lawyerly thing to parse words like this, but the question is there a difference between to get involved versus the wording of the tweet, which is to assist? And I think there's probably not. I mean, it's a different kind of emphasis. It's a different mode of rhetorical emphasis on the one hand to say you will not get involved versus you will not assist or affirmatively assist. But it's really saying the same thing. I mean, if I'm reading the governor correctly, he's basically saying we're not going to get involved here. I mean, maybe we'll kind of delay the, or maybe hypothetically speaking, because Trump's obviously going to surrender himself. So maybe hypothetically speaking, we would have kind of gummed up the works a little bit and kind of delayed administratively the signing of the paper. But Governor DeSantis is a very smart man. He knows that according to the text of the Constitution, according to the Supreme Court case, Puerto Rico versus Branstad, if this really were to be litigated, then a federal court could force his hand. So that's my basic take on the situation.
And I think, Josh Hamer, that you're correct on that Governor DeSantis just said more particularly in his tweet what he had already said that audibly in response to a reporter's question. And I know that there was a lot of parsing of that, and there was more emphasis on his kind of snarky comment about, you know, well, I don't know what goes into paying hush money to a porn star, which, you know, it is true. I'm sure that, you know, he doesn't have some of these same issues that that President Trump does in his past. But nonetheless, you know, there was a lot more focus on the politics around that and the optics of that than what he actually said relevant to extradition. So so interestingly, though, when he is saying that Florida won't assist, and again, you know, President Trump has said he's going up there. So this is just more of an exercise in, I think, what is an interesting question, not just legally, but also politically. Our friend Will Chamberlain, who is also another great attorney, he tweeted this: why isn't Trump refusing to surrender? Ron DeSantis has made clear he will protect him from extradition. Time to fight. And a lot of people, myself included, asked that question. Why not, when you have the governor on your side, why wouldn't President Trump try to fight this on all levels? And even if this is as perfunctory as a federal judge signing a writ of mandamus and saying, okay, well, we're going through the motions, why not force going through the motions in case there is some other way that DeSantis may be looking at this legally. And why not make the Manhattan DA go through all of the motions instead of just going up there and saying, okay, sure, fine, I'm here to meet the man and respond?
Yeah, so I don't have a good answer to that question, Jenna. I share your instinct. I thought Will Chamberlain's tweet was basically spot on. You know, Trump can't necessarily have it both ways here. I mean, if you think back to his initial Truth Social post a couple weekends ago, I think it was over Saturday, where he said, in all caps, he was kind of raging, like I heard that they're going to indict the former president. If you think about what his quick reaction was himself, as well as the reaction of some of his closest surrogates, it was actually very little about the indictment. And very, very quickly, the attention shifted to, oh, what is Ron DeSantis going to do? I mean, that switch from kind of a coordinated social media and surrogacy perspective happened very, very quickly. And, you know, the governor now has done exactly what I think Donald Trump, at least on paper, would have wanted him to do. So that does raise the obvious question as to why are you not going to play along with this? Why are you not going to string this out? I mean, it does call into question, I think, to put it mildly, the earnestness or the seriousness with which Trump and some of his closest surrogates were purporting to criticize Governor DeSantis for his allegedly lackluster response to the news of the indictment, which I kind of thought was perfectly fine and deliberate all along. But the reality of what's going on here, from my perspective at least, and I'm probably the only one who has this take, is I think President Trump on a certain level wants to get indicted. I mean, look at the fundraising numbers, Jenna. Look at how much money the Donald Trump 2024 campaign has been able to pull on the news of this indictment. I think $4 million, right, just over like a 48-hour period after the news broke this past Thursday or something along those lines. I can't remember the exact hour frame, but it's a fundraising boondoggle. And, you know, I'm sure that on the one hand, the idea of having to appear in court, the idea of a mugshot, I mean, that's terrifying for any human being, obviously. And just to reiterate, this is a disgraceful, an absolutely disgraceful, legally baseless, and abhorrent abuse of prosecutorial power from a Manhattan County prosecutor who never, ever prosecutes violent crime, homicides, gun crime, gun trafficking. It's all dramatically on the rise in New York County, New York, but they're choosing to expend the prosecutorial resources on this. It is an utter, utter farce and travesty of justice. But having said that, it clearly is, from a pure fundraising perspective, good for the Trump campaign. I think a lot of folks are of the opinion, perhaps not wrongly, that this will help Donald Trump secure his grip on power in the Republican primary, at least in the short term. It's not obvious to me that this helps him in the mid to long term, but at least in the short term, it probably will help him kind of consolidate power in the 2024 primary. So to me, that's why he's not going to kind of force Alvin Bragg's or a federal court's hand here. I think it's really more about the fundraising and the politics of it. But it does call into seriousness the earnestness with which he and his surrogates purport to criticize DeSantis, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I would agree with you. I'm talking with Josh Hammer, who's the opinion editor at Newsweek, and you know, and you also have the Josh Hammer Show, which is an excellent podcast that I highly recommend as well. And, you know, Josh, as you and I have talked about this as well, you know, offline, I mean, the focus of Trump, when everybody around him, including Ron DeSantis, is so focused on the weaponization of government and how this is such an unprecedented, ridiculous indictment. And I echo all of your comments on how heinously abusive this is of the system, all of that. I think it was surprising. I mean, not really surprising for those of us who have followed Trump and know him, you know, over the last 7 years. But I think it was surprising a little bit to see that his initial immediate focus was on his political opposition or the guy that he thinks is going to be his primary top rival, instead of coalescing the country and specifically the Republican base around this kind of sham proceeding. And so what do you think is going to be the more the more long-term political aftermath of this, because right now he has the bump in the polls that may or may not just be kind of that artificial bump as people are reacting to this. And I think rightly people are outraged about it. And so they're wanting to support him in pushing back against the weaponization of government. But we still have a lot of time before the Republican primary. And do you see this kind of tenor of being so myopically focused on the politics of it instead of the rest of the principled approach, I suppose, would be one way to contrast it. Do you see that ultimately being helpful for the campaign, or do you see that actually playing into some of the other campaign's favor, whether that's Ron DeSantis or someone else?
So I definitely think that the short-term effect to help Trump consolidate power, the so-called rally around the flag effect, I definitely think in the short term that is very real. And I thought it was very real in the aftermath of the raid at Mar-a-Lago last August, which I also profusely criticized at the time. My column that I wrote after that raid was just utterly lambasting the FBI. I titled that column American Stasi, with the Stasi being the infamous East German secret police. So I was harshly critical of that as well. But from a political perspective, I mean, the natural effect of things like the Mar-a-Lago raid, of things like this unprecedented crossing of the Rubicon, a point from which we can never turn back, of indicting a former president, yeah, these naturally will, at least in the short term, help Trump's fundraising numbers, help him get, you know, bigger and better rallies in Waco or wherever the next rally may be, and all of that. But it is not at all obvious to me that that same salutary effect will carry over for the mid to long term. As you very accurately note, it's April 2022. The Iowa caucuses are about 10 months away. There is a lot of time, and we're talking a lot about Governor DeSantis. I mean, you know, there's so much time until the Iowa caucuses that Governor DeSantis has obviously not even announced that he's running yet. And there's a small chance he doesn't. I happen to think he probably will, but there's obviously a small chance he doesn't. So there's so much time left. And one possible effect that the Alvin Bragg indictment might have is it might persuade some of these other rogue prosecutors in Georgia or in Washington, D.C., to potentially indict President Trump as well. So, you know, he's under potential criminal investigation in multiple jurisdictions. But none of these, from my perspective, have legal merit to them. They are all dubious of one layer or another. Ironically, the Alvin Bragg prosecution in New York is probably the single most dubious of them. It is the single most farcical and baseless. But there's the situation in Georgia where Trump, after the election, was calling Brad Raffensperger. There's been a longstanding kind of investigation there. There's Washington, D.C. when it comes to all the January 6th committee. We're still waiting to hear what Merrick Garland and the DOJ do with that. And then, of course, there's the classified document situation about the Mar-a-Lago raid that I just mentioned. So there's a lot of potential criminal activity. Again, from my perspective, all of these cases are legally dubious, but the natural effect of Bragg kind of being the first out of the gate to indict a former president and setting that wretched precedent from which we will never go back does have the natural effect potentially of getting these other prosecutors there. And at that point, Jenny, you kind of have to ask yourself, you know, if you are kind of torn between multiple candidates, let's say it's like December, January, it's the lead up to Iowa, it's the lead up to New Hampshire. I mean, do you really want to roll the dice with someone at that point who was potentially under two or three criminal indictments? I mean, you know, unless you're like a really, 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 really hardcore Trump supporter, if you're even kind of remotely considering your other options, I think it's pretty easily foreseeable at that hypothetical future point where someone might want to choose a different path forward.
Yeah, and I think that that breaks it down really well, Josh Hammer. And there are so many variables that we still have to contemplate heading in to the 2024 primary. And so, you know, this isn't done yet. And like you, I think that Ron DeSantis will jump in. I think he should jump in. How that plays out, well, we'll have to continue to wait and see. But thanks so much. So that's Josh Hammer. You can follow him at Josh_Hammer on Twitter. He's the opinion editor of Newsweek. And that's it for this morning of Jenna Ellis in the Morning. We'll be back tomorrow ahead of the Manhattan indictment and the arraignment. So we'll be with you tomorrow.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.